back, ladies and gentlemen. Today is going to be about love. So a little something about the show itself. You know, I've got dozens and dozens of these shows. And what you should know is I probably recorded at least four shows and lost them due to technical difficulties. Accidentally erasing the footage out of the camera. Thinking I'm erasing an old one. I end up clipping. And one erase, I deleted two videos, and it was literally one video from one of the sessions I did and another video from another session. Lost that. One time I forgot to plug in the microphone. Utter genius, right? Sometimes I just don't like the show. I've done at least three shows where I got to about 45 minutes. I was realizing this is horrible. This isn't, you know, gelling together. I'm too lost in the process. So today, I'm just going to say right from the very beginning, it might be one of those videos because I'm going to try to cover the esoteric nature of love. I'm not going to necessarily tell you how to get it, how to maintain it or anything like that. I think I would be, my opinion would be just as good as yours, you know. But what I'm going to riff on here is something that just occurred to me in the last couple days, maybe even the last 24 hours from where I am sitting right now. It's always fascinated me that love, it's sort of the proof of consciousness for me. And not just because it's an intangible concept, but, you know, we look at the universe, like a scientist will look at the universe and say, there's force in the universe, force that holds things together, force that pushes things apart. And it's all just, you know, if it's not tangible, a scientist can't really get into it. And you do have some existential scientists looking for other ways of taking the intangible, making it tangible, like multiple dimensions and that sort of thing. But love is a force. Love is a force that drives our reality more than gravity, okay? Than any atomic force that you can put your finger on. Love is utterly phenomenal in its existence. But it doesn't exist everywhere. But exists a lot more places than I think than we're willing to give credit to. And that's what we're going to get into. I saw a video once, and some of you have probably seen the same one, where a scientist was covering primates in the jungle. And there's a sad, sad scene where a monkey loses its newborn. And she carries the monkey, the baby monkey, with her for days and days. I can't remember how many days. And she mourns and she cries into the jungle. And there was absolutely no room for interpretation on this. That's what was going on. And you could tell it made all the other monkeys feel uncomfortable. I believe in the video there's even a section where another monkey comes over and tries to console. But they're always picking on each other, you know, in a sort of friendly grooming way. When I saw that video, I thought, it's not like I don't understand animals having love. But by God, that was just as human as loving as a human has, you know. And of course, we're all raised to think that because we're Homo sapiens and we managed to dominate the world, that everything starts at us and works its way down. We're always above every other animal's concept of anything. It's the hubris that keeps us alive, right? A lot of you have seen the videos when the soldiers come home from war and their dog, who hasn't seen them in a year or 3 years, sees them and runs up to them and just is barking and crying and is so happy that the owner's home. I don't care if you're not a dog person. If you have at all any empathy in the world, it will bring a tear to your eye when you see it, right? We have to also assume that love exists in things and creatures in ways that we simply can't track it because we don't have the ability to hear a cry or hear a laugh or happiness, right? But you would think that hive mind creatures like bees that serve their queen must be operating on something. And of course, instantaneously, everyone's going to go, oh, it's just an insect. It's just all instinct. And of course, you're right. They're going off and doing these amazing, journeys to find pollen, and the way that they triangulate their little tail movements to say, hey, it's over there, 10 feet, 50 feet, 100 yards, a mile. I mean, come on. The honeybees are some of the most amazing creatures on planet Earth. But what if there was a little bit of love in them, too? What if it being a hive mind, perhaps it's way more advanced than humans? You know, ants are the same way. They serve the brood. So you feel me. Love is potentially a lot more places than we ever give it credit for. But that's not what occurred to me in the last 24 hours. I think it's Sally Fields, right? She, the famous actress who played opposite Burt Reynolds in Smokey and the Bandit. She gets the Oscar. She goes up and she's notorious for having said, you really like me. You really like me. She sort of has this bizarre introspection live on television. There's no problem with that. She was just speaking out loud what she was feeling, what we all feel, what every single person who goes up there and grabs that reward feels. She simply just said it, and people try to make her out to be crazy or weak or whatever. No, she actually just, I think, gave us a gift. And I think she's at the heart of what love means to most of us. Whether or not we want to admit it, whether or not we realize it. I think that, love is many things. I do know that. And as Prince said in the movie Under the Cherry Moon, define love, right? And you can't. I'll give you a word analogy. The cosmologists of the universe are now figuring out that the entire universe is made of electricity. It's just a current of one energy, of one force, of one probably collection of particles or a single particle that give us the illusion of electricity. And it's the different velocities that give us the sense of, if fast-moving invisible energy and slow-moving matter that we could use to make fingertips and hold cigars, right? I would say love is a universe unto itself, overlaid on top of our universe, and that one of the currents, one of the things that travels in the current of love, is a sense of purpose. I think that love is the affirmation that our existence is worthy. And it doesn't matter where we get the love from. If you're really desperate for it, if you're hungry for it, if you're starving for it, you'll take it from anywhere, whether or not it means anything or not, whether or not it is a true confirmation of your purpose or not, we will take it. And we're fine with it. And hey man, there's probably nothing wrong with it. What is interesting about this idea of love being the current of purpose, because just think about it. Think about when you are in a situation where you are loved for something, right? Now, at the most rudimentary level, you're loved by someone else, another fellow human being. And then you feel a sense of purpose because you're being loved by another. Then when you have a baby, you feel a sense of purpose that you're going to love the baby more than anything has ever loved you. And you become this protector. So one is being loved, and you have this purpose. And of course, being loved typically means you love the person in reverse, hopefully. Because if you don't care about their love, then you're in you know, you're not in the situation that you would really think about it, right? But when you're in a, you know, a relationship or something, or in your family member or something that you really care about and they love you and you love them, boom, it's part of your purpose in life. When you have children, well, that you know that they don't know you exist just yet consciously, definitely know you exist subconsciously. And so you apply it the other way. But it's interesting how, as an artist, you can love something. In fact, art could be anything. You're an accountant, you're a painter, right? You're a singer, whatever it is. You can love an activity. And that activity, loving, will give you a sense of purpose. I'm meant to be a painter in the world. I'm meant to be a whatever in the world. You know, it could be anything. I'm meant to run a corporation because I love it. I love the process of taking what I've manifested as a human and establishing it onto the universe, right? Realizing it, as they say. But for a second, I want you to think about the notion, right, that the universe wasn't created from nothing. That old argument of the is that we talk about on the show every once in a while. You know, a bunch of inanimate mass just floating around in infinite space, a finite amount of energy floating around in infinite space, would just be sort of some weird moment in existence. It would never gain consciousness. It'd just be some stuff floating around in the universe. Okay. It's probably happening somewhere. Probably several universes, right? But ours is a little more advanced, right? We have a consciousness that is married to mass. And again, there will be scientists that have a hard time with admitting they don't know things, and so they, again, will kind of go with the bag of chemical theory of everything because they think, oh, we opened up the brain and touched it, and we, you know, someone felt emotions, had a memory. So it's just all in the brain. We just don't know how it works. Because they have 3D eyes, and they can only believe what they see. And so, you know, they're waiting for some postcard from God to believe in God. Or forget God, but just a consciousness layer on top of it, right? But what's weird is we know we need forces in the universe to hold together everything that is an object in the universe, right? That's a given. What we don't seem to believe is that there would need to be any other force structure on top of our consciousness. One, to create a consciousness, you know, we're looking for the God particle. We're looking for the most fundamental unified theory to describe how all of this mass that we see with these mass eyes, right, exists, to give ourselves some comfort, maybe to create some Nagrathian company where we can build planets, right? But we don't seem to think that we need to understand consciousness on the same exact level, right? It's just consciousness is some sort of indirect outcome of mass coming together, which obviously I think is nuts. You know, again, we're so indoctrinated early. And I think indoctrination is, it has a principle something like this. You know, if somebody says, are you smart? The first thing you don't realize you actually ask yourself before answering the question if you're smart or not is, what do I think is smart? What's the paradigm of intelligence? And I find it amazing that, you know, I've got obviously a whole band of friends at different levels of knowledge and experience. And it's funny when someone from one group of my friends who has, you know, tremendous experience, traveled the world, academically is very amazing, professionally very amazing, and they say, this guy over here, this girl over here is really, really smart, and you got to meet him. And I meet him, and they make my brain hurt. They're so damn smart. And then I'll go to a different category of my life where it's more rural area. The people I'm talking to have barely left the state of California in their entire lifetime. Academically, they're at zero. Their research in the world is zero. And they say, oh, you got to meet this old man. He's so smart. And you meet the old guy, and he is just stuffed to the brim with official stories, with low-hanging fruit, with cliche knowledge. And you're just like, oh, my God, this is intelligence? And it's all referential. It's all general to whom, you know, the area that you are. And so I think that when we... I mentioned that example because that shows you a difference in, and you've all experienced that, right? It shows you a difference in the paradigm of thinking, the extent to which one thinks. You know, the official story, remember, is a way to look at infinity as a finite box. That's what an official story does. It puts absolutely, you know, four walls, a ceiling, and a floor around the question by which you're trying to debate or question in your own mind. Whereas an open mind, say, truther person knows that regardless of how much you think you have witnessed and partaken of the truth, you'll still die without all of the truth in a particular area. You know, and you know, we hear about this all the time where perception is everything and we see things through perceptive eyes, which is what philosophy is all about, is to open up the perception aperture of your mind. You know, again, I've said it several shows ago, but I'll repeat it. You know, I used to think that philosophy was bunk. You know, I thought when I was really young, I didn't understand it. I thought, you know, even in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when they were turning on the computer Deep Thought, it talked about how these pundits sit around and philosophize about the universe, which means they never really work. So there's been some derogatory views in with a tongue-in-cheek on philosophy that I think affected me as a kid. And eventually I figured out, no, the philosophers of the universe are really your interstellar Magellans, interdimensional Magellans, your metaphysical Magellans. You know, they are constantly exploring the universe. They are constantly exploring what it means to be alive, what love means, what anything means, what our purpose is in life, how to view, how to assess. And so I have a great respect for that. And I think that when we talk about love or an emotion of any kind or a paradigm of existence, we struggle with just off-the-shelf knowledge. And if you think about love, you know, it's almost as ubiquitous as existing in a mass energy body, right? Most of us do not wake up in the morning and think, wow, I've got all these atoms that are in my control. I've got this, you know, these energy waves that are in control. I'm a frequency receiver. I'm a holographic universe entity, and I'm now doing this, and I'm now doing that, and I'm now doing this. You don't think about that. That's too, ain't nobody got time for that. You know, we're all, we just have to get on with life. But what's interesting is I think every second of existence, we're actually contemplating some measurement of love every split second. You don't love getting out of bed. Some of you love getting out of bed. You go in and you like the taste of your toothpaste. You don't like your taste. You like to brush your teeth. You don't like to brush your teeth. You like getting in the shower and feeling warm. Oh, you hate getting wet and having to dry off. You know, and the whole thing goes all day long. Well, I like my car. I don't like my car. I love this drive to work. I hate this drive to work. I love my job. I hate my job. And it's this emotion that we have constantly about a certain opinion of other things. And it's weird how when we apply it outward of our own opinion, we apply it outward, we don't necessarily get, you know, the positive feedback that we get or the same sort of feedback we get from another human being, right? You can go outside, look at your Lamborghini and go, God, I love this car. This is my favorite thing on the planet Earth. You get in and you hear the engine roar up and you're like, oh, shit, this sounds incredible, right? But it's nothing like a human being coming up to you who you think is beautiful as a person, and you think that their love, for me personally, you know, it's like the more that a person's loved is discerning, is they make choices in life. They don't love everything in life, but they've, especially if they've had other people in their life, and they go, you know what, out of all the people I've ever been with, you're the one. And, you know, the pounds per square inch of amazing feeling that you have from a human being telling you that absolutely blows away your love for inanimate objects, you know? It really gets down to that old saying, you know, money doesn't breed happiness, right? Now, I think most of us understand there's a minimum amount of cash before that analogy really starts to make sense, but what I used to always tell people when I moved to California, and because I was taught that survival was damn near impossible. You know, it was like, you're going to be in a ditch. You're going to, you know, it's just like, if you don't have a college degree, you'll never get a job. Boy, is that a bunch of bullshit. You got to self-educate, but I mean, it's just crap that someone's not going to take your skills just because you don't have a piece of paper. Yeah, it's not me, man. But the interesting thing about love, if you think about it, the poorest person on planet Earth still gets a body. The poorest people on planet Earth get to live in this reality. And hopefully, you know, I would love to say everybody has food and water, but I think in 99% of the cases, that's usually the case. People can find enough to sustain on. But I think it's interesting that love, which is sort of this mandatory resource of existence, is free, and it's out there. And if you've managed to allow your body and your mind to get in a place where you don't feel loved, or loved enough, there's two different things there. You know, the chronic example of not being loved at all, well, you know, it could be that you no one's neglecting you, it's just you put yourself in a weird situation in life. But it always seems to be there. There's always seems to be something there. People get pets all the time, because pets are just little love machines, you know. And even though their love might be sort of, you know, more mechanical, you know, they do love you. A lot of them do. Dogs do, at least. Never forget, if you don't feed a dog, it'll eat you, right? If you die on the ground of your house and you don't have, and no one knows you're there, and your dog is sitting there trying to figure out a way to survive, they'll eat you. It always happens, right? Now, I learned a very intense lesson when I first moved to California. And I had moved here, or, you know, you guys hear me say this shit all the time. I'll give you a little more insight here. So I came out here by myself. And, you know, because I was a professional programmer before I came out here as a kid, or at least I had that much knowledge, I immediately got into that, got into my art, got into all this other stuff. Okay, old story. But what ended up happening was, I got here probably in August, August 19th, 1987, and I got one trip back, because my mom sent me tickets in Christmas time to fly back and visit the family back in Kansas. So I flew back home, did that trip. Then I went probably all the way around till about June the next year, where I had a weird thing occur. Now, I've told the story about the fact that my buddy lured me to a music studio by going through a church, right? The guy who owned the music studio turned into a pedophile eventually, because that's what youth ministers do at churches, right? He did 2 years in jail. Five girls, 13 and up, right? And what happened for me before all that happened was that I went to this church. And sorry, my microphone's covered with dew. I went to this church, and it was sort of like, you know, I had been working around the clock. And I mean, at the time I went to this church, I think I was working 12-hour days. I would come in at 6 o'clock at night and work till 6 in the morning. And I worked a normal shift before. I elected to do this. I don't know why I did this, but I just decided to be the big night owl. And I was cranking out work, helping to make TurboTax. And I went to this church. I got into this youth group, bunch of kids around my age. I'm about 18. I guess I was 18 at the time. And I've got kids, you know, between 16 and probably 19 or something around me, right? So it was kind of cool. I was like, all right, I can dig this. You know, just companionship is something I didn't realize I didn't have besides my more academic associates, right? Which we did hang out and party as well. But there was just something about not having that be connected to work that was beneficial, right? So anyway, what ends up happening is I'm leaving on the first visit, I think, and one of the elders who I ended up living with his family came up and just gave me a big man hug. You know, he's a big guy, so he's all, boom, hey man, good to see you, good to meet you. He grabbed me, and when his hand went around me and he squeezed me, I had this amazing feeling, an epiphany of, holy shit, no one has touched me like that in probably a year. Maybe when I left Christmas, maybe my old man gave me a hug like that or something. But I got this feeling and I was like, oh, like I have been without human touch for months and months and months and months, right? And so, you know, I made a conscious choice at that point to put myself in situations to start kind of branching out, you know, because when I was in the Midwest, I was very active with all my friends and always had a girlfriend and that kind of thing. And when I came out to the California, I was so terrified of failing that I just worked my ass off, right? Plus, I was getting paid by the hour, so working those 12-hour days really put a lot of money in my pocket, even though I managed to overdraw my account probably once a month. Over time, it took me a long time to really build up, but it was actually pretty interesting because I think within the year I met my first real serious girlfriend in California, who ended up being an exchange student from Germany. So as much as I was successful in that, she had to go home, you know. But I'm trying to think of, let's say you feel what I'm saying. You feel that love and purpose kind of go together. And I want you to, if you don't really feel that connection right now, I'd love to hear your impression the next time someone makes you feel very loved. And think about the word purpose in your mind. And see if you don't get one feeling attached to the other. Love comes first, washes over you. And it sort of gives you a purpose. Now, just thinking, I'm just riffing here. I didn't sit down and plan all this stuff. What if people who feel like they've reached the end of their life, you know, they're suicidal or something. What if that is merely the sort of pocket of existence where your consciousness that needs to exist isn't getting fed by the feeling of love? Remember, I talked about those babies from time to time that were not held at the maternity ward and they all started dying. I think being held is obviously a loving activity. The women who work in those areas and the men nurses that work in those areas, they love babies. That's why they're there. It's pretty hard not to like a baby, all right? But some people don't. That's fine. But there's a caveat to love. We know that Robin Williams was loved. If Robin Williams had a dollar for every human being that felt like they loved Robin Williams, I dare say he could start his own film company very quickly. He could give half of it away and never have to work for the rest of his life, right? But somehow, Robin Williams got to a point in his life where he killed himself. And he's just one of many, right? It didn't matter that we all loved him. And I think that gets to the next stage of love, which maybe we shouldn't be so good at, but some of us are, I would say. And this is not an accolade by any stretch of the imagination, but it goes like this. For those of you who are parents, how many times have you tried to affirm your child with a statement and they just don't care? They're just like, yeah, well, you have to say that. You're my dad. You're my mom. But then they run off and they get the dopey, stupid friend, okay, who has no experience, just as old as your kid. And they tell your child, I really love you, or you're really smart, or whatever affirmation it is, and all of a sudden it matters. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that necessarily, because it's just the way life is put together, but think about that. Some of us qualify love. I have always struggled, and this is going to sound stupid to all of you who own pets, but I have always struggled with really giving any merit to pet love. And I have loved pets, man. My buddy Bobby Blotzer, his dog Jack the River passed away a couple years ago, and it gutted me, you know. Because we went to Lake Havasu together. Jack's just an amazing dog. He's just an amazingly talented animal, just a sweet animal. And he had his goofy moments too. He always barked at the anchor of the boat. We had to anchor the boat, which we only did twice a day maybe. He lost his freaking mind. Like it was like Cthulhu was wrapped around the anchor in some alternate dimension, and he could see that us pulling the anchor out was releasing the devil. It was weird. Every other moment of the trip, this dog was the most sentient, beautiful, mature animal. It's really strange, right? But Robin Williams, I can only assume, was qualifying all of the global love for him as perhaps not being the sort of love that mattered to him, you know? His sense of purpose. Or perhaps, you know, I know it's more complex than that. A man of that intelligence and that caliber is not to be itemized in a little phrase, right? Or summarized in a little phrase, excuse me. Perhaps his life goals were just unattainable, you know, in his mind or something. You know, I know that he was supposedly suffering from various ailments too. So he was looking at having issues moving forward. Maybe, I think it was like Alzheimer's or something like that. It was getting on his back. No one really knows anyone's personal life, of course, but we see suicides happen. And, you know, what's interesting about the Brady Bill here in America, which is the 7-day waiting period to get your gun, is that it puts a 7-day waiting period between your desire for a gun and actually being able to have one. Now, what's kind of silly is that, you know, if you're prone to own a gun, you probably will go get one no matter what. And then there's the Brady Bill. It doesn't really matter because you can make a hasty decision and do something crazy, like blow yourself away. Or unfortunately, maybe somebody else, right? Now, suicides sometimes are, I guess, massively premeditated. People have been thinking about it for years as sort of an out. And some people do it, you know, sporadically, spontaneously. And it's because of feeling, I think, unloved. I really honestly believe that that ecosystem that keeps us alive on the consciousness level is not being fed to any degree. And so it's a moment of, it's like a free fall. It's like a free fall of, and it, well, let me ask you this. Let's just frame the statement I'm about to make. For those of you who have ever been dumped from a relationship that you were totally into and you didn't see it coming, even if you should have seen it coming, doesn't matter. Or you've lost someone in your life that's your partner in life. Your sense of purpose sort of fleets away from you in that moment. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? I was meant to be with this person my entire life. Now, the math on the subject is, well, there's actually someone else just as good, if not better, as the person you found. Even though you haven't found them yet, even though it might be very tough to find this person, there are people out there that are for you as well. That are good to be with, right? But we'll forget about that. When you're in that fleeting moment, it's very disorienting. You feel empty inside, right? As we say, the emptiness, we sometimes, I think, we just call it, well, I'm feeling an emptiness of love. But I think, why does that matter? Because it's an emptiness of purpose that love seems to fuel within us. And, you know, for those of you who have, you've survived one of these situations, you know, maybe you never really contemplated suicide or anything, but you were up at a point where you felt absolutely horrible, absolutely empty inside, due to a relationship breakup, maybe a loss. If you ever make it through one of those moments in life, then it really equips you for the next moment when you feel like that in life, right? And so, you know, when we see our children go through those things or our friends go through those things, I think that if you're the type of person to try to console someone or coach them through surviving those horrible emotional roller coasters, you're drawing from your experience to say, no, no, look, I've been there too. I know that I don't know how you feel exactly right at this moment, but I've been close to this moment. And in time heals, and there are other people out there, and we got to survive this thing, right? One of the things I try to pay attention to in life that's kind of related to this is anytime I hear about someone surviving something really tumultuous. When I was in high school, I took this class called Death in Lit and Survival in Lit. It was probably one of the most brilliant classes I've ever taken in my entire lifetime. And what we did for one semester, it was either a semester or a 9-week period, half a semester, is we studied death. And this is where I got a chance to go to all the mortuaries in my local area where I lived, and we got to look at the death books. And death books are, person died this day of this cause. And this is where I developed the unanimous opinion from my own mind that we do not live longer today than we did 100 years ago. Because regardless of the method of death, which never was cancer, okay, it usually was something very simple, like died in their sleep, da-da-da-da-da. But people were in their 80s, 90s, and hundreds in these books. The average age must have been late 80s, both men and women, you know? And as the years got closer and closer to where I was at the time, which was the 80s, the death ages went down, down, down to the point where dying in your 60s was actually pretty damn common. But in that class, we studied the Chilean soccer team, football team, that got stranded up in the Alps, right? Their plane crashes, and miraculously, this pilot manages to, I think he lost his life, but most of the soccer team lived. A lot of the people on the plane lived, right? For those of you who don't know the story, it was like the Donner Party. They had to eat each other. And so they would start eating the dead bodies of humans, right? And it's gruesome how they figured out how to do it in such a short period of time. Of course, this would never happen today with all of our satellite technology and just planes in general. But I guess this was in the 70s, I think, this happened. I can't remember the years at all. It's sort of irrelevant, but it got to the point where they needed to actually, they realized they needed to journey. They were waiting for rescue and no one ever came. And so like, man, we have to climb down from this really high mountain to this absolutely horrible terrain covered in snow, rocky cliffs and stuff underneath the snow. It was just bad. And so they draw straws and they develop a team to go out and get to the bottom. And I remember the part that I could never forget. There's two parts of the story. One is when they made the first choice. Someone made the first and took the first initiative to eat a person. And some people say, you know, that's God telling you, you need to die. But the second part of the story that just to this day, and I hope this isn't information you don't want to know, is they were walking down the mountain. If one of them died, one of them did die going down the mountain, and it wasn't like they fell, they just expired. They ate this person super fast, and they talked about the process of eating this person. And, you know, it's horrifying to think that anyone would be brought down to that level, right? But now the survival part of it, because this is in my survival part of the class, is that they got to this absolutely rock bottom point in their life where they did feel like the universe was against them. Completely and utterly against them. Perhaps if there was an almighty being, that mighty being is saying, this is your time to go. I need you to nut up and just die. But they decided to live. And once they got their mind clear after surviving, I'm sure they felt like they did the right thing. And the people that survived actually became very eccentric people. At least some of them did. One guy managed to get to the point where he didn't feel any pain. And he would go around giving demonstrations where he'd he'd poke needles through himself and all kinds of stuff. And he just, I don't know, that traumatic experience up on that mountaintop got him to a point where he had to ignore pain. Otherwise, he wasn't going to make it. And he seemingly permanently removed pain out of his life, like physical pain, or he could meditate it away or something, right? But I think because life is now full of, and I think life has always been full of ups and downs, of course. There's all these great sayings about, you know, you can only go up when you're, when you finally reach rock bottom, the only place you can go is up and down. It was really funny when I, at one time in my life, I had really bad credit. And I tried to buy a car once. And I actually was making money, but I'd had someone actually cause me to lose a lot of money. Personally, I was loaning the money, and it was just I managed to borrow too much money too quickly. I wasn't paying it back fast enough, so I couldn't buy this car, and the guy ran my credit. And it was like that old scene in The Simpsons when I think Bart Simpson tries to buy a car, or buy something, and the finance manager runs his credit, and all of a sudden this siren goes off on top of the this, like, you know, what do you want to call it, the canopy light or whatever, starts going off on top of the computer, and he goes, he goes, "Oh, is that siren good?" He goes, "Oh, you ever know a siren to be a good thing?" I had sort of had that moment, right? And this guy looks at me, and he leans back in his desk. Of course, he wants to sell me this car. And there's always a finance company that will sell you a car with the shittiest, you know, finance rating. And I think he realized I wouldn't have been that kind of guy. But he said to me, he goes, "Well, you know, like my father used to tell me," he goes, "life comes with peaks and valleys." And he goes, "Apparently you're in a valley right now." You know, it's really funny. So I try to study people who survive things. I try to study my own ability to get through something tough, because I know that the more I understand it, the more I'm going to use that knowledge moving forward. I just will, because I will be down and out again in my lifetime. And you know, and it's all relative, right? You know, it could be you have $10 million in the bank and you just can't get this one thing to happen and it's just not working. Maybe you become so eccentric that no one wants to be around you, and so you're like, damn, you know. Luckily, I haven't had that problem just yet. But, yeah, I think that love is, in its simplest sense, it's undefinable. And for those of you who don't know my Prince reference, there's a, you know, he made three movies in his lifetime. I think only one of which is worth watching, which is Under the Cherry Moon. Purple Rain was obviously the big one he made in the early 80s. It's very, Purple Rain is very generational. Like, you need to be kind of in that dopey era of life and have seen it when it came out to really have it make any sense to you. His third movie, Graffiti Bridge, was just the most bizarre thing on planet Earth. It's all shot inside the studio, besides a few live-action shots in Minneapolis, driving the car around, but it's just dark and weird. But Under the Cherry Moon had it was a French movie. They actually bought a script off somebody else and then sort of remapped it to Prince and what his needs were. But the script was actually fairly solid. It could have been anyone in that script and it would have been a good movie, but they made it black and white as well, which I think was the right decision. And there was just a point in the film where, probably a couple points in the film, where the lovers got to the point where I think she said to him, "Do you love me? Or tell me that you love me," or something like that. In the back of this car, and this is bum actually watching, there's a beautiful convertible American car in the south of France, and instead of answering the question yes or no, which is the traditional thing you say, metaphorically, he just said, "Define love." And then they actually played the title track, Kiss, you know. Actually, it wasn't the title track. I guess there was a song called Under the Cherry Moon, which is also good. But at that point, you know, I'm about 16, 17 years old seeing him say that, "Define love." And I thought, whoa, that's really interesting. Yeah, how do you define love, and how do you get two people to agree on the definition of love? And so about a year and a half later, I was just about to move to California, and my jump was to go from my little hometown, go 100 miles over to where my mom lived in Wichita, Kansas, and then drive all the way to California. I haven't just done a trip to California in a car, in a truck, where I set up my job. And my mom's like, okay, we have something to tell you. And he goes, Chris and I are engaged. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. Chris is a cool dude. And so, but they also seem like fairly different people on one level, because I didn't know the guy that much. He was cool, but I didn't know. So I said, okay, let's play a little game here. And it's all based off seeing Under the Cherry Moon. But this is what I did to them. I was 17. And I said, okay, get a piece of paper, both of you. Different piece of paper. And they had sort of this booth in their kitchen, like this round booth, like you'd have in a restaurant. And I said, okay, I want you guys to widen your hemisphere away from each other so you can't see what you're doing, can't see what you're writing. I said, now, if you're going to get married, that means you supposedly have a belief that you're compatible with each other. I said, I want you to write down your definition of love. So no less than 10 things that make love love between two people. And I watched them get really nervous. And so they wrote down all these phrases, and then they compared them, and they're laughing because I think out of like 10 or 15 things that they thought was love, they may have had 3 or 4 words that were the same words. Now, obviously, they're married to this day, so it's totally worked out. But they laughed, and I could see almost like an insecurity in these adults from like, okay, well, we do need to reconcile what we believe is love, right? So if you're ever in a situation where you think two people need to have a little exercise, it's a fun one. It's actually pretty cool. I've never done it twice, but I just think that these two got on the same page in one way or another with that experiment. I think, too, let's just say you get me on this purpose thing, right? Love is the feeling and affirmation of purpose. At least that's what it gives us. I think the weird thing about our consciousness, if you're really going to split the atom from a philosophical standpoint, is the real question of, because I think you guys probably feel me on this, which is, why do we need a purpose? Why do we feel like we need a purpose? It always seems that those are the most unhappy with existing, even if they're too afraid to leave this world, which I hope you don't want to leave this world no matter what, but there's people who are miserable and you're like, well, why don't you kill yourself? And you see these in movies all the time. Well, I'm just too chicken to do it. Don't do it, all right? But why do we need purpose in the first place? And that's where I always try to, that's where my mind comes to the point of like, we are more than just inanimate mass. Does a rock need a purpose? Does a tree need a purpose? Does your tree get depressed and die? Nope. It gets a little beetle in it, maybe a termite, maybe it doesn't get watered, maybe a fungus grows all over it, but it only dies because of some sort of mechanical interruption in its existence. It doesn't need a purpose to exist. And obviously a rock doesn't have any metabolism in it, so we think, well, that's not alive because it doesn't perform its bodily functions like I do. Doesn't appear to have an ecosystem of existence, it just is. But no one denies the fact that a rock exists. But think about it. What if you, in the next 10 seconds, had someone snatch temporarily for 1 minute every sense of purpose you had to exist? Now, without having that actually occur, most of us can feel the tense void that would exist in our system, right? I think I admitted in the dream episode, I had a dream once where it was a very short dream, but boy, it was profoundly, it was a super duper profound dream that had nothing in it. I woke up in some, it was the most utter void that I've ever been in my life. I was floating in a void. What does that mean? Well, I don't know if I had clothes on or not. I don't sleep with clothes on, so probably didn't have any on. But I'm floating in this blackness. There's no gravity pulling me up, down, left, right. Didn't get the sense there was no floor underneath me. I was literally like floating in water. But there was no water. Nothing was refracting in my eyesight. And what I could see, without actually having a true light source in my scene was all these little fibers and particles, like, you know, like carpet fibers floating in the air, you know, when you see it on a summer day. And I was just there. Nothing else was there. There was no consciousness addressing me. I was just floating in a void. And I remember sort of wading in it like water. Like, it almost had sort of a resistance to it. I definitely didn't have like thin air feeling. It had a thickness to it, but it looked like there was just air in this world. At that point, in that particular vision, I remember, one, it was sort of waking up in this state, and then taking a few seconds to contemplate, well, what's going on here? Where am I? You know? And as I realized that I was nowhere, I remember getting a quick flash of panic that this was going to be it. That I was going to be in some hellish void. And, you know, people might say, well, hell and brimstone would be a hell of a lot worse, and I'd probably agree with you. But that was pretty damn bad, too. Being in a void. You know? And so that was me getting sort of like this weird deprivation tank of no purpose. And when I woke up, I remember feeling much, much better, that I actually had a purpose. I actually had an identity. I actually lived somewhere. People knew me. And it was, I guess there would probably be, you know, without a purpose, you sort of get that feeling of loneliness at the same time, I guess. Now, when I moved to California, I didn't have anyone around me. And so my ability to care about that started to disappear. I went through, you know, national holidays, except for Christmas, you know, went through Thanksgiving, which is where my family got together. I got the phone call from the family when they were together eating around the table and I wasn't there. I'm 18 years old, man, you know, and I've grown up with this sort of ritual in my life, not appreciating it most of the time. But I had to focus, right? And I love my work. I love where I lived. I love getting up every morning looking at palm trees. I love the fact that it didn't snow in wintertime. I loved going to the beach. I love Disneyland. I mean, I was in a nice place, okay? But it was because of my relative value system being asserted on my life that I actually was able to find different things to love. My purpose was in my work. And I was always appreciated by my coworkers. So that gave me a sense of purpose as well. But a large part of my personality got really hard. You know, I couldn't care about things. I spent birthdays by myself. You know, my 18th birthday, I spent in a room that I had just squatted, reading Misery by Stephen King. You know, as I'm turning up, it's the big 18th birthday, and I'm sitting there doing nothing, you know. Eventually, my buddy came home from work. All of us worked at Jim Hall Racing in this house, and so I did my shift. And he came home later on. I finally just said, you know, it's my birthday. He's like, oh, shit. And so we went to this arcade and fucked around all night. It was pretty funny. But by the time I started dating regularly here and got my circle going, the people that I dated were, you know, they wouldn't see the reaction from me that they would normally get from a normal person who grew up in California and had their family there and always, you know, had these rituals and stuff. So Thanksgiving would come around. And I swear to God, it took me probably a decade to give a crap about Thanksgiving again. Not because I didn't like it. It's just I couldn't care for years, you know? Because even if I had someone, you know, you break up and eventually it's a couple of years where you don't have that circle, you know? And you go to friends' houses and you eat that kind of stuff, but it's not like your grandparents and your aunt and uncles around you and that sort of thing. And it's unfortunate that we don't typically as children appreciate those moments. And then when we get to be adults, we're not always with our family members or they've passed on or something like that. By the time we really like to sit around and have a decent conversation. So if you're in a pocket where you actually have that family circle, even if it's just friends that you consider your family, you're fortunate. It's good, you know? So I'm trying to figure out how to conclude this. I wanted to beat this up from a bunch of different angles. You know, in 2013, I started spending that summer, you know, really down at the beach here in Huntington Beach, and I would get up every day and do a little bit of work, and then I'd go get my lunch, downtown. It was a pizza place. And I walk across the street and I have my little book with me. And it was really nice summer. It's beautiful. And I take this little book, it's an empty book. You know, and I just observe reality, you know, and I was really philosophizing about the whole thing. I've talked about this a couple of times about consciousness and a life force. And after I had all these different ideas of almost physical models for the intangible, sort of trying to see the ecosystem and maybe how a consciousness comes together with this electrical universe, whereby, see, a Fibonacci pattern is one thing, but life is another thing, you know, that goes through the Fibonacci pattern or whatever it is. Anyway, I thought, what if someone walked up and said, you know, started engaging me in conversation and said, oh, I really like where you're going with that. I've got some money. Let's research consciousness as a separate force in the universe. And the exercise was, how would you do it? You know, when they discovered electricity in the 1800s, they had wires and magnets and wood. That's pretty much it. And that turned into everything that we use today. The electricity is running this camera right now, right? But that science is based off of a tangible mechanism to observe what you're trying to isolate, and you can all you know, you can make mathematical predictions, and then you can pass your observational analysis across the world on the other side of the planet. Someone can take your experiment and reconduct it and see it on that side, and that's the benefit of the tangible. So how on earth are you going to pierce the veil of research into a consciousness? Because that's why so many people are so sure there is none. Because it is really, it's sort of like, it's such a big concept. You know, that old saying that you can't hold a thought of God in your mind. God aside, they're definitely conceptual things that are so massive we can't contemplate them. You know, such as, what are the barriers of the universe? That's a concept so huge you can't really conceive of it. I want you to conceive of every number that could be generated, every number that exists on every plane of existence in the numerical systems. You know, a base 10 counting in the positive, base 10 counting in the negative, fractional counts in the same, you know, hemispheres of positive and negative polarity. Like, you can't conceive of that. It's too much information for the brain to conceive as we're designed today, right? Maybe if you had some really good acid, you could pull it off. So I think that the real answer to my question at the beach is sort of what this whole episode's about, which is, we have to feel the experiment occurring, because we're not going to be able to write it down on a piece of paper as a, hey, do this and you're going to notice this, right? But if there's even two of you out there, or let's reduce it to one. Let's say there's one person out there watches this video and you're like, you know what? You're right. When I feel loved, I feel purpose. Well, I've given you an experiment into the consciousness that you can sense. You know, what is it? Aristotle, who came up with the idea of close your eyes and envision a perfect circle. Now open your eyes and take your hand and try to draw that perfect circle on a piece of paper. And you can't. And that was his proof that there's another realm of existence, which is heavenly, or, you know, consciousness, or a God. And so that allowed us to all, we could all run that experiment. We can all feel that. But that seems sort of technical and not lovey-dovey. Our whole obsession with objects is because I think we believe that having a really fancy object is going to get us loved by other people, or at least become the bait to get the person into our circle so that they will love us for who we are. You know, you look at the Wild Kingdom, you know, all the males have these incredible coats, you know, like the Red Robin just looks amazing when you see him in the Midwest, you know, but the female Robin, I think, is just brown. And what I always try to tell everyone is, look, females design males, males design females. So if you want to see the actual external realization of how men and women are different, Mars and Venus are different, okay? Women are pissed off that they don't age very well. Men enjoy the fact that we age really, really well in most cases, right? Well, that's because women picked the men that they wanted to have sex with, and men will have sex with anything, And so women don't have to be as amazing as they think they have to be, because men will sleep with you if you want to sleep with them. And sure, they want the hot, whatever, hard body girl. But the second he can't get that hot, hard body girl, he's going to have a couple drinks. He'll just be fine with anything he finds. You know, and the more intellectual the person is, they don't care in the first place, right? Same with females, right? But females are more discerning with what they want to be with. And I think that that programming, all, you know, you think about it, okay, what if males and females had the same exact programming for how we like each other? That'd probably work as well. But it definitely, it created a weird thing when males became more left brain, I want to orgasm, I want to procreate. One of those two things makes a guy have sex, right? I think orgasm's probably in both columns, but that's, I mean, we're problem solvers, right? Men are just very left brain problem solvers because, again, the burdens of life aren't emotional. The burdens of life are mechanical. Hunt, get food, prepare food, feed. That takes care of your belly. And then bring the rest back to the tribe. Once you civilize, you bring the whole thing back to the tribe. And someone in the tribe has figured out how to prepare the food better. So it tastes better than you just chomping on it in the middle of the woods, right? So I guess what I'll just say is, as you think about your emotions, I'm going to say, try to dissect them. I would love for, in fact, if you guys have any videos, you know, that gets into this deeper, or books that you know that really get into this deeper, please refer them to me, because I am a mortal man and usually books of this nature have really bizarre titles and so it's hard to search on them. But, you know, if you have philosophers that you know have done a really good deep dive on this, I've definitely read my own versions of it. What I find with most, you know, psychologists, psychologists and psychiatrists, excuse me. Your philosophers, like your Marshall McLuhan's, do a great job at it. They do tend to get very focused on a discipline because they're forced to write papers. They're forced to produce something that's very cut and dry, black and white within a discipline of thinking. And so even though a person might be utterly ingenious about these things, sometimes they get too focused and they don't, you know, like they need to, in my opinion, they would need to do it, their philosophy, a bit like a musician makes a series of albums. This album sounds different than that album sounds different than that album. That's what I liked about Prince my entire lifetime, was that no album sounded the same. It was like the guy was utterly reborn every time he made an album. And then of course in the 90s, it all started sounding the same. So I think, I don't know, I feel like we have a great group of folks listening to these. And again, I'm just the puppet. I'm just like, I'm not even the puppet master. Jeez, I shouldn't have said that. I am sort of just like the the random guy shouting things to think about maybe. And yeah, so let's end it there. Send me your stuff if you have anything that's literally someone trying to dissect consciousness as a true entity, using maybe experiments that we can all mutually conduct within our own lives to see if we're on the same page. Because who knows, maybe something distills out of the whole process that helps us stop war, that helps us stop trying to, I don't know, upset the balance of nature. Let's put it just that way, right? Anyway, if you made it this far, thanks for listening. As I always say, MKUltraRadio.com for the feed. And I don't know. Take care of yourself. Love somebody. Appreciate the love that you do have, because it's probably all good. Some love will most likely feel better than others. Know that I love you. All right. Take care of yourself, and I'll see you in the next episode of Deep Thoughts. Over and out. Say you wanna get away. We don't need a plane. Could be your escape. Take you to a place where there's no time, no space. I could be your private island on a different planet. Anything could happen.